Hey, welcome along. It is 5 p.m. North American Eastern. Ah, no, it's not. It's 4 p.m. North American Eastern Time. I'm springing into summer or falling back to winter. I forget which it is. Too soon. It's 4 p.m. North American Eastern Time. 5 p.m. in the Canadian Maritimes. 5:30 p.m. Newfoundland and Labrador. 9 p.m. Greenwich Mean Time. 10 p.m. in Western Europe. 11 p.m. in Cairo and Jerusalem. Midnight in Moscow. For all you Kenny Ball fans, I always keep referencing that song of Kenny Ball's. It's a fantastic record, and I should stop talking about it and just play it one of these days on this. It's midnight 30 in Tehran. For all you wacky Ayatollahs who dig the half-hour time zones, you're the spiritual cousins of Newfoundland. Gander is twinned with Coombe, I believe. And, of course, it is the weekend. It's Saturday morning. For our listeners in Asia and the Pacific. And wherever you are, we welcome you along to one of our Clubland Q&As. All 7 billion people on this great earth are free to listen to this show. If you want to ask a question, you should be a member of the Mark Stein Club. If you want to join right now, I'll make a point again to your question. But we have lots of other good things too. The latest in my series of video poetry, because video poetry is where the big bucks are. So my latest video poem can be seen at Stein Online. It's The Low Down White by Robert W. Service. And if you only know Robert W. Service from his shooting of Dan McGrew and the cremation of Sam McGee, or the shooting of Sam McGee and the cremation of Dan McGrew, whichever it is. If that's all you know, Robert W. Service from, The Low Down White is one of my favourite Robert W. Service poems, and that's the latest in our entry on video poetry, because video poetry is where the big bucks are. Let's get to your questions. Impeachment is in the air. We saw the engrossment ceremony. That's what it's called. Don't ask me why. The engrossment ceremony. And that doesn't quite live up to its title. I was not really engrossed by it. Tucker put some Munchkin music on to accompany the march of Nadler and Schiff. I was grossed more than engrossed by those two walking across to deliver the impeachment articles to the Senate. But it's on. I've seen all this before because I was there for the trial of Bill Clinton 21 years ago. So I know how this thing goes, and it's not going to be as interesting this time. Allison writes, Molly Hemingway just called impeachment the pornography of Trump derangement syndrome. Do you think the Democrats will be able to quit their terribly dirty impeachment habit cold turkey after President Trump wins again, or might they just pick up a newer, slimier habit? Yeah, that's the way to bet. They have spent his entire first term trying to negate the result of the 2016 election. If Trump wins in November, which is the way to bet right now, if Trump, in part because of the carry-on of the Democrats these last, and the media these last 4 years, if he wins again in November, they're going to just double down on their efforts, Allison. I've no doubt about that. Todd Williamson says, love the Clubland Q&A. Nancy Pelosi betrayed her true motivation for Trump's impeachment when she said he will be impeached forever. She reminds me of those nut jobs who used to run up to people wearing expensive fur coats and throw red paint on them and run away. Pelosi feels that in some way she has harmed him permanently. My question for you is, she really that stupid? Does she think that Trump's supporters, all 63 million of us who took a chance on someone with no political record and have witnessed everything that he has done for our country, is going to care that her good-for-nothing house has impeached him? Frankly, I could not care less. Yeah, 63 million. That's really who she's impeaching. And this is with respect to the president, I think, where he doesn't, he ought to emphasize this a bit more in his rallies. That essentially, in subverting him, he's subverting the 63 million. In other words, she's not impeaching President Trump. She's basically impeaching 63 million Americans who voted for him. She's nullifying your vote. Now, again, my enthusiasm for the checks and balances of America's constitutional order has waned somewhat in the last 4 years. It should have waned for you too when you look at the way secretive, powerful agencies have been able to engage in banana republic behavior. The thing about the banana republics is they're kind of quite upfront that it's all about naked power. Everything here gets coated with a sort of pseudo-constitutional veneer that frankly it doesn't merit. There's no doubt the remedy of impeachment is an extraordinary remedy, which is why it was not used basically for the first century of the Republic. Then it was used, not used again for another century, and we now currently are approaching the situation where it's used on every other president. That is not something that the founders foresaw. And it's particularly absurd to impeach a guy in an election year, because what are you going to do? You'll have a trial and you'll remove him from, convict and remove him from office, even as people are voting in the primary in New Hampshire and South Carolina and Nevada and Super Tuesday and all the rest of it. That's completely ridiculous. You're in effect establishing a kind of super vote, the kind of equivalent of the super delegates who screwed over Bernie and the Democrats last time round. You're saying, okay, there's these 63 million people. They have all this ordinary one man, one vote thing. And then there's this elite group of super voters who get to pass judgment on the people's vote. That is something that the founders would have regarded as utterly repugnant and is the most significant feature of this, that three of the jury, so-called, three of the 100-man jury who will be voting against Trump are people who are actually seeking to replace him. Actually, four. There's Bernie, there's Elizabeth Warren, there's Amy Klobuchar, and there's this Bennett guy from Colorado, the one who doesn't get into any of the debates. Let's see where we're going. Perry Patetic writes, so the slow walk of the fake impeachment articles was all about choreographing the CNN debate with the latest allegations from a dodgy Ukrainian, some DNC crook in the GAO, that's the general, whatever it is, I can't remember, what does the A stand for? Government Accountability Office or whatever it is? And the late delivery of Pelosi's poison pen so that Biden gets a free pass. The problem with all this is that Biden uses every opportunity he can get to destroy his campaign. Yeah, basically, there's only going to be two people on the stump for the next few weeks. That's going to be Biden, who doesn't even know what state he's in half the time, and Mayor Pete. And Mayor Pete could conceivably win Iowa and New Hampshire. And then for mysterious, fluffy, rainbow coalition reasons we're not allowed to talk about, is suddenly, when we move to South Carolina, is going to come nowhere. There is an element of choreography to all this, and one shouldn't disdain it. As you say, the upshot is to leave a candidate out there who is as incompetent a candidate. This is actually the problem with so-called Democrat moderates. The moderates lost last time round because the moderates were represented by a crook, a dirty, sleazy, corrupt kleptocrat. Now they've gone exactly the same way. Joe Biden is more likable, certainly, than Hillary Clinton. He's, if anything, he's even more woozy and out of it when he's campaigning and has to be managed even more carefully. But he's even dirtier. He's got an even dirtier scam going on. It's just about conceivable that there are people who sincerely believe all those Kazakh oligarchs and Saudi princes are giving money to the Clinton Foundation because they're genuinely interested in ameliorating diarrhea in Africa. There is no way, the minute Hunter Biden's name is out there, the minute Hunter Biden is being talked about, you understand there's no reason why anyone would give him a dime for anything. He's a complete talentless nothing of a guy. All you're buying is his last name. And so the Democrats are making, the Democrats centrists, this is the challenge for the Democrats. On the one hand, you've got these rather pristine, purer than thou, and that's their whole thing, purity test, purer than thou socialists. Represented by the AOC wing. Then you've got the moderates, and everyone says, oh, well, you know, if only we could get the party, drag the party back from the crazy side to the moderates. To do that, you have to stop the moderates being such bloody, awful, dirty, rotten, corrupt thieves. And the Democrats show no sign of willing to do that. That's the great problem there. John Wilson says, Mark, I'm trying to decide who the Democrats resemble most. Wiley Coyote, who keeps running off the same cliff. 2, Sylvester the Putty Tat, who keeps sawing the tree limb on which he is sitting. Or 3, Yosemite Sam, who keeps blowing himself up with his own dynamite. What's your analysis? Well, they're all, the great thing about Looney Tunes is they're all essentially the same jokes. But I do believe my personal favourite is Yosemite Sam, because I think shoving the dynamite in your own pants is the most brilliant reductio of that joke. Looney Tunes cartoons are fantastic because essentially they set up what's going on and then they just repeat it for 6 minutes and then it's over. And one of my very favorites is the one where Yosemite Sam and Bugs Bunny are at some kind of circus and it's a high diving act, the one where you climb up the big ladder and then you dive off the ladder into this thimble of water, basically. And Bugs keeps Bugs is supposed to be the one who's diving off the board into the bucket of water, but he somehow keeps contriving the situation so that it's Yosemite Sam who's always heading off the board. And I think that is actually, to go back to what we were talking about earlier, I think that's what's happening here. If you're a politician, a lifetime politician, being impeached is a serious business. If you think you're Nancy Pelosi and you've done nothing but be in Washington, D.C. in politics all your life and you get impeached, that's a bad thing. If you're Chuck Schumer and you get impeached, that's a bad thing. If you're Hillary Clinton and you get impeached, you're a bad thing. But I think we all understand that the net effect of Trump being impeached, continuing to run and winning again, the net effect of that would be to damage the very concept of impeachment. Nancy Pelosi says he's impeached forever. I don't think it works like that, because the whole point about Trump is they turned to Trump because, in a sense, the electorate had impeached the entire political class. As I always say, you know, the geniuses who run American politics, their view was that the 2016 election should be between Jeb and Hillary, between the wife of the previous president and the son and brother of the previous president. I mean, it's stupid and it's insulting. And essentially, the electorate impeached the political class and removed it from office and said, no, we're going for this guy who's got a game show and sells a line of neckties at Macy's. And that's why the rules don't apply to them in the same way. And I think that's that the impeachment doesn't affect that. Impeachment confirms it because it's the madness of the political class. George Pazin, whom I occasionally mispronounce as Georges Pazin, says, down and dirty, Mark, who's winning the Democrat nomination? With the exception of Tom Steyer, I think you could make a case for those still standing, and yet I feel like there's no way any of them are going to win it either. It's feeling more and more like it will end up coming out of the convention, another thing I didn't think was possible. Well, I agree with Van Jones, the commie in residence at CNN, who said he didn't see any of these guys as being able to take down Trump, and he's absolutely right. It is coming down to Bernie or Biden. Bernie is going to be at a significant disadvantage in the 2.5 weeks now leading up to Iowa, in that he's going to be silenced all day. He's just going to be sitting in that room all day. They hated it. The guys hated it last time round, the senators. They're obligated, but you never see them sitting together. It's a fake legislature. They don't have debates. They don't have anything. They're hardly ever in a room with each other like that. So there's like 100 guys who all think of themselves as Gulf Emirs, and they're suddenly extras sitting there in this thing with the Chief Justice and the House impeachment managers. And I watched them last time, and apart from Strom Thurmond, who was pressing little oranges, satsumas and so forth, and candy into the hands of Clinton's comely young lady lawyers, and you'd see his from up in the press gallery, I'd see his leathery old hand slithering like some primeval lizard across the hand of the lovely Clinton lawyers and pressing candy. Apart from him, nobody else had a good time. And it's going to be even worse this time, because four of them know they're having their presidential campaign screwed over by the Democrat establishment, which wants to stop Bernie Sanders doing to the Democrats what Trump did to the Republicans. That means the opening is for Biden. If they nominate Biden, they're going to be nominating one of the weakest, most feeble candidates ever. Then you've got Bloomberg. Bloomberg spent, I think he's already spent $150 million on ads. And in some of these later states, he left it too late to get into Iowa and New Hampshire. So his whole thing is forget Iowa and New Hampshire; it doesn't matter. And he's going to buy himself a significant poll advantage in the later states. And I don't know. It's an odd time in American politics, and doing something that breaks all the rules worked for Trump last time might even work for Bloomy this time. But it's going to be one of those old guys. It's going to be Biden, Bernie, or Bloomberg. Because even if Mayor Pete were to win in Iowa and New Hampshire, she's got a few problems down the road. Let's see what else have we got here? Owlman from CA, which I believe is California, says, "Hi, Mark. For today's live stream, I initially thought I would be asking about the expedited collapse of civilization. However, after listening to you on the Oakley show, I believe the British monarchy crisis has taken precedence. You are the solution. This is how it works. Meghan will become a diversity consultant for big bucks in Hollywood and for the DNC. Harry will be doing weight reduction and recipe ads for Oprah, clad in Media Matters approved plaid PJs. And the icing on the cake is that the Queen will then adopt you as her son to fill the void. After all, you have schmoozed with the royals in the past. You could rule a section of Canada, Whistler, my favourite bit, and invite your new mum on the next Mark Stein cruise to be on stage with you and Michelle. Just not sure what your title would be. What say you? You know, the thing is, Al, it's cute. But I will say this, one of the things, ever since this story broke, I've been invited on, you know, Tucker's had me on to talk about it. I talked about it on Rush. I've turned down invitations hither and yon to talk about it elsewhere. And people always assume, because Harry and Meghan are just celebrities in America, so you just, when something happens to celebrities, you hire someone to come on and make a few jokes about celebrities. You know, that's, I've done that on Tucker before, when When some, you know, when Robert De Niro mouths off about something, Tucker brings me in and I do a couple of minutes of Robert De Niro mouthing off gags. And they're all a little surprised when I'm rather more serious than they expected about Harry and Meghan, because if you're a subject of the Crown, it isn't really a laugh in the same way that it is to Americans, for whom it's just like celebrity gossip. And when you put it like that, Al, you remind me that at this stage in my life, I thought by now I might actually be Governor General of Canada. A couple of GGs back, when Michael Jean was made Her Majesty's Viceroy in Ottawa. And Madame Jean was a lady who, she used to come on after the news on the CBC News World Channel, as it was called then. And she would do these, she would present these left-wing documentaries. She didn't make them or anything. She just introduced them for 2 minutes every night. It was called The Passionate Eye, I think. And she would just come on and introduce, and they were all left-wing documentaries about how great Cuba is, about how Haiti is a fantastic governing model for Canada. It was all left-wing documentaries, one after the other. And on the basis of that, she was made Governor General. And somebody in the Literary Review of Canada said, well, if we have to have an undistinguished Montreal hack for Governor General, why can't we have Mark Stein? At least it'd be a laugh. And I quoted that line. I was speaking in Ottawa to an audience a couple of years ago, and I quoted that. I've quoted it a couple of times. And every time I read out that thing in a speech or whatever, the whole room laughs, and I feel a little hurt. Why is it entirely normal for an undistinguished Montreal hack of the left-wing CBC persuasion, like Michael Jean, to become Governor General, whereas even raising the possibility that I might be Governor General gets a laugh? So I feel it's kind of a tragedy. At this stage of life, I would have liked nothing better than to be wandering around Nunavut, pinning medals on deserving Inuit breasts on Her Majesty's behalf. So it's not funny. It's no laughing matter. Ben Poser writes, Dear Mark, he writes from Boston, just down the road from me in my northern woodsy vastness. A few hours down the road, Ben Poser writes, Dear Mark, one thing which has crossed my mind lately is, should the United States be considered an unofficial member of the British Commonwealth? I'm perfectly fine with us skipping the feathery pomp of the Chogham every other year. That's Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting. Although there's a very rude acronym that civil servants in Whitehall used to use for it. But the US owes its entire physical and political existence to the transatlantic expansion of the British Empire and is still quite closely tied to the mother country through our traditions of government by consent, trial by jury, common law, and most importantly, the tongue that Shakespeare spake. Should Brexit be the opportunity to fully recognise this reality, however unofficially? I don't know about that. I think over a couple of centuries, you can actually, I think you're right that you would find so-called, constitutional conservatives who would disagree with this. But in effect, in 1776, a group of British subjects decided to take essentially English ideas of liberty a little further than the metropolitan power was prepared to entertain. And that's, the beginning and end of what happened in the American Revolution. In effect, it was a kind of British Revolution, but unlike the French Revolution or the Russian Revolution, it was staged in the provinces, as it were, as opposed to in the metropolis. However, time goes by, 2.5 centuries go by, and I do think, to a certain extent, Views can diverge somewhat, dispositions can diverge somewhat, and I think I think Americans are different from Englishmen in a way that Canadians and New Zealanders and what have you aren't quite in the same way. The other thing I would say is that the Commonwealth, unfortunately, the Commonwealth is of such a size and scope right now that I don't believe it would be it's not a useful model. I'm not sure. I hadn't really thought about this until I am a conservative, so my natural inclination is to stick with things as they are. But I was on stage with Nigel Farage a few years ago, and Conrad Black put this to him, that if you were to take the United Kingdom and Canada and Australia and India, you would have a GDP that would be about the size of the United States. So a post-EU, post-Brexit Britain should maybe consider the Commonwealth in that way. And Nigel Farage said, well, you know, maybe, but whatever it is, it can't be called the Commonwealth. In other words, I think attempting to reform that. Certainly America, you know, the reality is that the Anglosphere is a thing. The Five Eyes is between four of Her Majesty the Queen's realms and the United States. It's America, Britain, Canada, Australia, New Zealand. There's a reason for that. There's a reason for that. There's a reason France isn't in the Five Eyes. There's a reason that Italy isn't in the Five Eyes. There are reasons for these things, and it's worth taking them seriously. Kate Smythe writes, Mark, for years you've drawn attention to the underreported, quote, Asian grooming gangs across England and their thousands of victims. We are looking now, Kate, actually, just on that thousands. I think you've got to reckon to something like tens of thousands now. Vulnerable girls as young as 10. And again, I actually think 10, I think it start. If you'd met some of the girls as I have, it starts younger. As well as the systemic cover-up of serious widespread crime. The entire apparatus of the state, from the political class to the police to the child protection agencies, look the other way for fear of appearing racist or Islamophobic. This week, another 20 men from Huddersfield in northern England have been convicted, and a review handed down on the Manchester police operation, Operation Augusta. The BBC reported, quote, police and social workers investigated child sex exploitation in Manchester. New children were suffering the most profound abuse but did not protect them. After a child's death in 2003, police identified at least 97 suspects, but very few faced justice, the Independent review found. The epidemic of sex slavery in England is no different to the sex slavery, i.e. the rape, torture, and murder of non-Muslim girls perpetrated by Islamic State. Will this phenomenon ever be confronted honestly, and will authorities in Britain who colluded be held to account? I was interested in this. I saw that the apology on behalf of Greater Manchester Police for turning a blind eye to the sex slavery epidemic going on the Greater Manchester Police's evil watch. The apology was made by a police officer called Mabs Hussain, and which rang a vague bell with me. And the bell it rang, you can see on our Twitter feed, because when I wrote about the fifth anniversary of the Charlie Hebdo massacre last week, a week before that massacre, the Greater Manchester Police had investigated a guy, arrested him, in fact, for burning a Quran. You can burn any book, as my friend Tim Blair in Australia said. You can burn any book in Britain except one. And if you burn that one, the police will investigate you and arrest you. And the guy who arrested that fella 5 years ago was, ka-ching, a police officer called Mabs Hussain. All that's happened in the last 5 years is that he's now been promoted to assistant chief constable. There is a, these are the two, the first is a non-crime. You may feel he shouldn't burn a Quran. You may feel this guy is guilty of ghastly bad taste. He's not committing a crime, not in a free society. Not in a free society. But the wankers of Greater Manchester Police, the evil wankers, preferred to fritter away the day investigating non-crimes, men who say Islamophobic things on Twitter or whatever, transphobic things on Twitter, rather than doing anything about 15, 14, 12, 9-year-old girls being sexually abused, sexually enslaved by gangs of, let's be blunt about it, Muslim men. Because it's for Rainbow Coalition types, it's problematic. White girls are being gang raped by Muslim men. Gang rape is, even in Britain, gang rape is generally regarded as not a terribly good thing. Except when it becomes multiculturally problematic, when it's the little 12-year-old white girl being gang raped and it's Muslim men doing the gang raping. The institute, this is actually fascinating to me, how multiculturalism corrodes the integrity even of the oldest societies on the planet when it comes to things like the integrity of a constabulary and that kind of thing. It's absolutely disgusting. And it would be easier to list the towns in which it's, because we know, you know, Rotherham was an exception. Oh, and then Oxford came along, and then Rochdale came along. Oh, and then Telford came along. Telford is a new town. Basically, this sort of thing, about 20 minutes after they built this lousy new town, this stuff started happening and stayed happening for its entire history. This is an exception, that's an exception, that's an exception. And now the latest exception is Manchester. There is something absolutely profoundly evil, not just in the conduct of the police and the conduct of the social workers and the conduct of the politicians and the conduct of the bureaucrats, but also in the indifference of the people. And as I always say, what staggers me is when I went to Rotherham and spent about a week in Rotherham, and I met those girls, spoke to those girls, and they took me around the town. And what shocked me was how few media interviews they had, in fact, given. There was one guy at the Times who was interested in them, and maybe they'd done a couple of others. But the crappy, worthless local press had done nothing, you know. Radio Hallam in Sheffield wasn't interested in the story any more than the radio stations in Manchester or the BBC. The BBC Telford or BBC Shropshire or whatever it is didn't even put the Telford story on its website, because they all understand. Like, if you're just some nothing guy in the newsroom at BBC Shropshire, if you're a guy in the newsroom at Radio Hallam, if you're a fella on the Manchester Evening Post, you know this story isn't going to be helpful to your career. It's just going to be an infelicitous adjective, and people will be complaining you're Islamophobic, and they'll be tying you up in inquiries and everything. It's easier to let the girls go on being raped, go on being gang raped, go on being doused in petrol while the gang dances around them, threatening to light them up. Go on being urinated on. Go on being dangled off the balcony. It's evil. It's evil. You know, I don't necessarily, you know, sometimes societies can wind up like overlaid area codes, you know, where they run out of telephone numbers, so they create a new area code that's later on the top. So you don't know whether you've got to, when you call somebody, whether you've got to dial 7 numbers or whether you've got to dial 10 numbers. You can have, and that's really what Britain and America and most Western countries are becoming. They're becoming these societies and essentially separate societies overlaid on top of each other. The people in the media don't really care about it. What do they care if some 12-year-old white slag gets gang raped, dangled over a balcony, you know, as they see it, some packy shagger, as the Rotherham Police, West Yorkshire Constabulary, dismissed these girls. What do they care? Their worlds do not coincide. It might be useful sometimes. If it all comes out in the papers and it threatens to embarrass you, you invite a few of them to number 10 Downing Street like David Cameron did, and you do your little reception with them, and then they bugger off and you go back. You're still in your world, and they're beyond the far horizon being urinated on and dangled off over the edge of the balcony. It's an evil thing. You know, I talked about America and the British Commonwealth a moment ago. I do genuinely believe that the modern world and the modern world's ideas for the last half millennium arose in a tiny, rain-sodden couple of islands off the coast of northwestern Europe, and they spread out all over the world. And where they have been seeded, that part of the world has generally prospered, whether it's Canada, whether it's Australia, whether it's India. But they are dying in the mother country. And Boris is jolly, and Brexit of a kind is happening. But at some point, this evil that is no, you know, it's not under the carpet. The carpet looks like the Jungfrau. There's so much that has been swept under it. You got to do something about that. Let's see here. What do we got here? Mark Shear says, it was fun to see you and Tucker talking about Helen Reddy's Iron Woman. Have you noticed, though, that you seldom hear this song played or referenced by the lefties, or even by the many radio stations that tout the music of the 70s and 80s? Odd treatment for such a path-breaking and catchy anthem, one might think. The answer assuredly lies in the forbidden words of what is now the darkly ironic third stanza. But I'm still an embryo with a long, long way to go until I make my brother understand. Yeah, is that, yeah, right. I hadn't thought about it. I don't think I've heard that far into the song in years. But I'm still an embryo with a long, long way to go until I make my brother understand. Yeah, that's right. I think I haven't heard that in a long time. Heaven forbid if we were to hear the musical thought that women and their political rights are in any sense embryonic. Indeed. It is a little problematic for that. Owen Morgan writes on a related theme, Rebecca Long Bailey was the darling of the British loony left until a day or two ago. She's the one who was a shoo-in to succeed Jeremy Corbyn. She's just as Marxist, but younger and with a double-barreled name. Then she committed wrongthink by uttering unacceptable opinions about abortion. Is the left now so stuck in the intellectual permafrost that even putative leaders are no longer able to express independent thoughts? No. You've got to have this whole sort of broad church thing. There's no room for you've got one of the ludicrous aspects of the Twitter Facebook world is that you have to be in lockstep on everything, and you can be in lockstep on 99.99% of stuff, and then you diverge and suddenly you're as, I mean, that's why I was enjoying my little, as some of you may know, on Monday I made a casual aside on the persuasiveness of Mayor Pete's gayness, and I found myself being excoriated by Big Gay on Twitter. I don't know why. I mean, it's an odd kind. I was complaining that he wasn't gay enough for my taste, but apparently that's totally homophobic. You know, have you ever seen that French film, The Closet, where one guy, he's about to be fired, so he starts a rumor that he's actually gay, so then they can't fire him because they'll look homophobic. And Gerard Depardieu, who's this homophobic member of the board, says, well, at least he's not a real flamer. It's funnier in the French, but it's still quite funny in the English. And of course, all his colleagues say, that's not funny, you can't say that. I'm actually complaining that Mayor Pete isn't gay enough for my taste. So that makes me... Gerard Depardieu was homophobic for saying, well, at least the guy isn't that gay, whereas I'm homophobic for saying, I wish the guy were more gay. But that's the whole thing. You can never get it right. You can never walk on enough eggshells to please these kind of people. And I was just thinking, oh, my God. So here I go. I've been pretty nimble. I've tap danced around so many things, so many potential pitfalls in this hideous new age. But now I've done it. Are they going to kill me because I said Mayor Pete wasn't gay enough? And fortunately, just at that moment, Stephen King said that he didn't think he votes in the Oscar nominations in the screenplay and a couple of other categories. And he said that he didn't take diversity into account. He just looked for the best film. And so if they're all made by straight white men, so be it. That's the way it's got to be. And he was immediately the party. He's a total lefty. He loathes Trump. His Twitter feed is as deranged as any of the other lefties. And yet they still piled on him. Still piled on him. So you can't have this now. And the thing about that is, particularly with abortion, which abortion is an evil and it is a tragedy and it has had tragic consequences in the way it has reframed our conception on what is our conception of what is valuable in life. But we are determined to invent more, there are so many deal breakers now, and you can do everything right, as Rebecca Long Bailey has done, and then one slight tiddly-widdly thing will make all that irrelevant. Someone has to stand up to these people. I don't think it's going to be Rebecca Long Bailey, but you never know. Toby Billing says, Sir Roger Scruton, the great English conservative philosopher and polymath, sadly died earlier this month. One famous seminal moment in his life was viewing the students rioting in Paris in 1968, and deciding then and there that whatever they stood for, he was against. Have you had any similar experiences that helped define your political standpoint? I wouldn't. I've always been of a conservative disposition. I'm not someone who ever flirted with any kind of radical leftism. I just found the whole sort of, student rebellion thing just too kind of smelly and chaotic for my taste. Just wasn't my thing. Roger Scruton, he and I were the panel. And that's not much of a panel, but the moderator was Mrs. Thatcher. This is going back a few years in the 90s. And Mrs. Thatcher adored Roger, and she thought I was there just for a few cheap crowd-pleasing laughs, which is basically the case. So Roger was stunningly, devastatingly profound, and Mrs. Thatcher rightly adored him. And I did a few cheap crowd-pleasing jokes, and Mrs. Thatcher genially indulged them because she felt it softened up the crowd for the profundities that Roger was offering. Dennis, Mr. Thatcher, Dennis was on my side because it had been a long day. So immediately the thing broke up. Dennis Thatcher came up to me, he goes, bravo! And he took me off to the bar and plied me with G&Ts. It's gins and tonic. We've got to get the priorities right. Anyway, he plied me with G&Ts. But what I mean by hard truths is that Roger was a genuine conservative. And so it wasn't... He thought about these things seriously. He was a lot of fun. He was great company, and he was very funny. And he understood also when he was asking too much of people. He had a wonderful essay on social dancing, for example. And he makes the point that a society that waltzes is more civilized than a society that does whatever it was that was going on, that the pogo or the Macarena or whatever the hell it was that was big when he wrote that essay. And he's absolutely right on that. He's absolutely right on that. But that's a difficult truth. It's difficult even among members of the Mark Steyn Club, who like they have a taste for the old rock and roll. And if you've ever been on a Mark Steyn cruise, you'll know that... late at night, in the bar, up in the crow's nest on the Mark Steyn cruise, as even the most impeccable social conservatives will suddenly start belting out old Rolling Stone songs or whatever. But Roger's not wrong on that, actually. A society's social rituals and courtship rituals, particularly social dancing, tell you a lot about what kind of society it is. I mean, I don't think there's any... You could look on the whole 20th century as a kind of war, a relentless war against melody, and which is slightly more of a specialised complaint, I would say, a war against harmony. And Roger was an educated and... civilized and cultivated person, and he took those issues seriously. And if you talk to conservatives in electoral politics, you know, they let all that go. None of that's 90% of what Roger talked about wasn't the hill to die on. He understood that. I was saying to him, I remember at the time Tony Blair was with his plans to wreck the House of Lords, and I said, you ought to speak up about this. And we had a little discussion about it. I said, you need to go and say that on the BBC. And he sighed and he said, that's not the sort of thing that lends itself to the sound bites the BBC is looking for. He was right about that. But if nothing is the hill to die on, you end up in the world where we are now, where all the pillars that sustain, all the pillars that sustain a conservative disposition in life are slowly chopped away. He was a great man. He was a serious man. And I do regard those contemporaries. We might as well name them. There's a guy called James Brokenshire, who was the Northern Secretary of State, Her Majesty's Secretary of State for Northern Ireland, and then became, I think it's some stupid title like Communities Secretary, whatever the hell that is. Contemptible little slug, nothing of a man. Pointless husk of a man. Nobody needs people like him. He behaved disgracefully. He got panicked by Twitter into firing Roger Scruton, and a contemptible little twerp of a man, another Tory MP called Johnny Mercer, not the Johnny Mercer, not the Johnny Mercer of Blues in the Night and You Must Have Been a Beautiful Baby and Moon River, not that Johnny Mercer. But a contemptible nothing little man called Johnny Mercer piled in. So the gutless, hollow, dead husk, believe nothing conservatives who hung him out to dry in his last year on earth, I do believe, we don't know about, cancer is a funny thing. You can have these incipient cancer cells just lurking in your body, and you do something that requires a little bit more stress, a little bit more energy, and that flares the cancer into life and it consumes you. And I do. I'll give you an example. Alan J. Lerner. Alan J. Lerner played tennis, and he got a little tennis injury. I forget what it was now. He sprained his leg or something. So he's laid up in hospital for 2 weeks, and the energy his body used fighting off his little tennis injury caused the cancer to come roaring to seize the moment, take over his body and kill him. And I believe something like that happened with Roger in the last 6 months of his life. Absolutely disgraceful. Absolutely disgraceful. Horrible people. Stephen Payne says, Mark, what do you think is the greater danger to our republic? A media that are full-on activists for one political side or a judiciary? Pardon me if I take the occasional sip. I've got a little bit of a dry throat today. Or a judiciary in which any judge at any level seemingly outranks the duly elected president. On a completely unrelated topic, every year your cruises go further afield from your home base there in New Hampshire. Are you working with Elon Musk to send the 2021 cruise into space? I would love that, actually. I would quite like that, as long as it was something more like an H.G. Wells type of spaceship or that Kipling-esque thing I read a few months back, going through space. Basically a 1900 version of a 21st century spaceship. I would love to do that. Actually, I had a question similar to this at Hillsdale, and some people felt that I wasn't Molly Hemingway from Fox News. Molly felt that I'd given the media a bit of a pass on this, but I think these are all because I'd said I thought the bureaucracy, and in particular the secret agencies basically organizing a coup, were the principal problem. The second thing of that I put is this activist judiciary in which, as I said on Rush the other day, there's, you know, the president of the free world is sounds like an impressive position, but he's outranked by any rinky-dink district court judge who wants to strike down anything he does. I think that's preposterous. I may say, incidentally, just to go back, tie it all together, one of the things... I might as well tie it all together, a big theme. But I was saying that I was always a bit wary about accepting invitations to go on American telly or radio and talk about Megxit, because the Crown is a real thing to me. Basically, everything in a monarchy, everything is rooted in the Crown. And so in Canada, the legislative branch is the Queen in Parliament. The executive branch is the Queen in Council. The judicial branch is the Queen on the bench. Now, you can Google those phrases. I didn't make them up. They're just like basic constitutional terms in a Westminster system. And to go back to whether America should be part of the British Commonwealth, one of the things that happened when it checked out is that in the absence of a monarch, you have to find countervailing forces to politicians in case politicians become too important. So one consequence of that, as it has developed over the last 2.5 centuries, is that the judiciary has become absurdly important and even more absurdly self-important. And it's one thing, I mean, to throw off one guy in ermine and replace him with nine guys in black robes in the role of the Supreme Court as the ultimate constitutional backstop. It's even more absurd when the idea of judicial review takes such hold that you can go right down to the bottom of the judicial food chain and guys there presumed to strike down the foreign policy of the United States. This is completely bonkers. And I would say, actually, one of the distressing trends in recent years, we saw it when with a ludicrous Baroness Hale and her chums on that little Blairite pseudo-Supreme Court that he cooked up in London. You've seen it with recent Canadian decisions. You've seen it with totally idiotic decisions in the Australian High Court. Is that view of a judge's role has spread around the rest of the common law world completely disgracefully. The media, I think, are different, because I don't think they help each other. I think a lot of these forces, Stephen, the media, the Twitter guys. Twitter is basically a media. Twitter is where third-rate media people go to advertise their wares. It's basically the small ads for journalists, you know. So you put a tweet out there saying you're going to be coming up on WZZZ in 20 minutes or whatever to talk about impeachment. So for media and minor celebrities, it's a way to advertise your ads. For minor celebrities frustrated at appearing in long underwear and flying through the skies in front of a green screen in X-Men 37, it's a way to advertise that, in fact, you are also a great thinker. And then it's also for all the wannabes, people who want to catch the eye of the minor celebrity or the media to sort of get in their Twitter feed and wreck their lives. And the whole thing goes on. And Trump is in there mainly just to troll them all every morning. So they wake up, see what he's tweeted, and then go off in pursuit of that mechanical hair round the Greyhound track for 24 hours. But the thing is, that becomes a self-reinforcing thing, driving them deeper and deeper down into a cul-de-sac. And I actually think, on balance, the greater danger, because it's a structural danger, is done by the out-of-control regulatory agencies, the out-of-control permanent bureaucracy, the out-of-control deep state, and the out-of-control judiciary. I'm never happier than when I'm being disrespectful to judges, and more people should try it. What do we have here? Timothy McDonald says, Mark, I enjoyed your look back at the career of John Barry. John was the composer for decades of the James Bond films. He was a fantastic musician. As you know, I made a record, a Goldfinger, and one thing we threw in the midsection of the James Bond theme in the middle of that, but we also put in a lot of little John Barry flourishes, Bond-esque flourishes, which I always like. I enjoyed your look back at the career of John Barry, where you spoke with lyricists Sir Tim Rice and Don Black and the composer David Arnold. In your discussion, Rice mentions that when John Barry asked him to write the lyrics for the theme song for the movie Octopussy, Barry mentioned initially that they wouldn't call the song Octopussy. Rice went along with this, so instead he wrote the lyrics to a song called All Time High, and it was sung by Rita Coolidge. And I like the song, but Rice mentioned in your discussion that he wished he had the stones to tell Barry that he would instead write a song called Octopussy, as he probably would have, quote, written a more intriguing lyric. I'm willing to pay $100 in advance if he will write the song. He'd already be in the black on this one, Mark. Do you think you can call Sir Tim and work this out? I can't wait to hear it, and it would be John Barry's best song in years. Think of it. You can produce. Mark Stein presents the songs that should have been. There is all the first rule of Bond songs, which Tim, as you mentioned, would accept if he were doing it now, is that you should always use the title of the film. In that conversation, Don Black got the call to do the song for Thunderball, and he goes, "Oh, great, great, fantastic! I'm doing a James Bond song." And he puts the phone down, and then he thinks, "Well, wait a minute, what is a Thunderball?" He goes, what's that? What is a song called Thunderball going to be about? And that's the great challenge of Bond songs, all the great Bond songs, Goldfinger, Diamonds Are Forever. It's all, you have to use the title of the song. And I don't think Tim needs the $100, but as I think I mentioned here at Stein Online the other day, he'd mentioned that thing where Harry is basically touting Meghan for voiceover work to Bob Iger at Disney at the premiere of The Lion King. And Tim dropped me a line saying that, in fact, he was also in that line, because Tim and Elton John wrote the songs for Lion King. You know, can you feel the love tonight, and Hakuna Matata, and all the rest of it, and all that stuff. And And he said he was talking to Harry about the cricket. So he assumed from the baffled look on Bob Iger's face that Prince Harry had gone down the line to see Bob Iger and was passing on the cricket score to him. And he didn't realise it was all that. So I might mention that. It's a great idea. It's a fantastic title. All the Bond titles should have songs with that title. Absolutely. Dominic writes, Mark, I have a broader cultural question for you about Facebook and social media. There's been a lot of talk about its effects on politics, marketing, etc. But to my observation, not that much about its effects on the erosion of human character, which to my mind has been far more profound than other alleged culprits, e.g. video games, airbrushed magazines, etc., from days gone by. It seems to me that it is and will be very difficult to raise young people, particularly young women, who are able to just live their lives for their own satisfaction, not caring too much about what others think. Zuckerberg et al. Have clearly tapped into a powerful need in many people, not just for attention, which we all desire to some degree, but constant attention. Do you have any thoughts or observations about this? I think you're right, which is why I think I listen to so-called conservative arguments that say these are just private companies and they should be able to do this and all that and all that, just as completely inadequate, as indeed many, sadly, many arguments advanced by Conservatism Inc. in the United States are. They're just simply inadequate to the situation we're in. Facebook and Twitter and the other members of the social media cartel are engaged in a huge project, which is in fact, I think, in some ways recalibrating humanity, and not in any good way. I've said before that what always interests me when you see a science fiction movie about futuristic dystopias and everyone's all walking around in these identikit cat suits with glassy-eyed expressions, that I never have really of interest in the dystopian future. I'm always interested in how we got from here to there. And I think we're right now in the getting from here to there phase, that I think there's persuasive evidence that social media is raising a generation that is simultaneously feels itself to be incredibly vulnerable and yet is unutterably vicious. I saw a bit of this in the reaction to my throwaway aside on Mayor Pete, with a quote unquote queer NB, which I think means queer non-binary college student called Riley. I just happened to see this as it came across the transom along with various others. But this queer non-binary college student called Riley just unleashed a series of tweets, blizzard of F-words, concluding with the words, the magnificent words, Twitter, do your thing. In other words, they should drive me to shut my account, vanish from public life, kill myself, whatever. And so you have this, most people do not want to live like Riley. But the reality of the social media world has been that it's kind of atomized people, where the more connected everybody is, the less human connection they are. And I think you can already see the impact of this in children and teenagers. Basically, we're now seeing the first generation of the first graduates of the social media age are emerging into adulthood, and this inability to connect except through the crude labeling of social media, which tells you who to like and who to hate, as opposed to just encountering the great rich tapestry of humanity and liking or hating them as you find them, or being entirely indifferent to them, which used to be the basic human position when we meet people. Now, on social media, you're meant to just like people or hate people. Pardon me, I'm just losing my voice a bit here. Thank you. Thank you for that. A Marco Rubio moment. Actually, I have another one. Don't worry. We'll edit all this out by the time we get it on air. Anyway, and I think that actually is something that is deeply, deeply dangerous. I talked about courtship rituals with respect to Roger Scruton. He's talking about the waltz and comparing, you know, doing the funky chicken or doing the pogo in the punk era or doing the Macarena or the Lambada or whatever, doing the bump, doing the hustle, doing whatever your bag is, comparing these unfavorably with the with the kind of controlled and sublimated romantic connection of the waltz. And he has a point. As I said, it's a different it is worth thinking. It's better to think like, just to come back to Roger, it's better to think like that than to do this pathetic thing that they do at National Review every couple of years, the 50 greatest conservative rock songs of all time, where you find some line in a lyric that most people, you know, barely hear as it's thudding around on either side of the great guitar licks. And attempt to argue that that indicates a profoundly conservative worldview. Roger took the view that it would take the view that that's nonsense. And I would add that conservatives look pathetic when they try to do that kind of thing. But it's actually even worse than the situation that Roger was talking about when he wrote that essay, because now people don't even do the bump or the hustle or the funky chicken or the Macarena or any of that. People essentially, young people sit at home, sexed with each other and engage in kind of hermetically sealed cyber relationships. And the idea that we have gone in nothing flat from a world of more or less kind of consistent courtship rituals into a world of friends with benefits, so-called, and then into a world where the friends with benefits can't even be bothered to avail themselves of the benefits, actually suggests that the intensity of life lived through social media has supplanted life lived through life for millions and millions of people, and that isn't going to end anywhere good. Isn't going to end anywhere good at all. It's a real challenge, and we have inadequate institutions actually to think about that challenge. And certainly the conservative institution, people get it. I'm a bit antipathetic to Conservatism, Inc. Because of my prolonged exposure to its general grifterism during the CRTV business with Carrie Katz and all. But beyond that, the questions that Roger Scruton thought of, and actually, just to tie it all together, he even wrote a novel based on what happened to those Rotherham girls. Roger didn't regard himself as a novelist, but all the great literary giants, the guys who get all the Booker Prize nominations, none of them wanted to address that. None of them want to, you know, none that for some reason that subject is too problematic for them, you know, because Mabs Hussain, Assistant Chief Constable, would probably go around, if you wrote a book on that and a bookseller in Manchester put it in the front window, Mabs Hussain would go around and tell the bookseller he was under arrest from the Greater Manchester Police. You know, it is time conservatism actually thought about, everything is changing very fast. You can see the difference now. One of the interesting things between the Charlie Hebdo thing 5 years ago and where we are now is that even the protests against what was done then would not be possible today. And some of the support that was given to the dead on Twitter would be taken down by the Twitter cops today as controversial, would be removed. So we are losing ground year on year on year. And it is time that conservative institutions, so-called, actually thought about this. And it is time, too, that this sort of philosophical purity, oh, Facebook's just a private company. YouTube, that's just a private company. Twitter's just a private company. Well, that social media cartel will dominate the planet. It's already bigger than most nations. Google has a $1 trillion market cap. It's bigger than most nations already. And we know that in China, these people serve the interests of the Chinese government. So they're learning things there. And you're a fool if you think they're not going to apply them here. And it actually suits the Chinese to have people just on Facebook all day, immersed on that all day. And you get the feeling it suits a lot of people here too. But it's not good for humanity. It's not good for human creativity. It's not good for the capacity to live your life to its fullest potential. This kind of strange atomized society where Facebook, the self-absorption of Facebook and Twitter expands and amplifies, in many respects, the most antisocial attributes that anybody has. You know, blowhards become blowhardier. Depressives become more depressed. It is a sobering challenge we face to roll this thing back before it's too late. We've gone on a little longer, and as you can tell, I got a bit of a tickle, a bit of a problem in my throat, and I don't want to lose my voice. The good news is we will be back with a video mailbox at the beginning of next week. As I said, we have, if you would like to join the Mark Stein Club, we would love to have you. And we have lots of good things. We have that latest entry in our video poetry selection, The Low Down White, a tough, gritty poem delivered by me before an audience of Mark Stein Club members. We will have a new Tale for Our Time starting, I believe, a week tonight. We have a great cruise coming up later this year, and we hope to see you on that. And in the meantime, we will be here thinking about these big subjects. I'll say something else about Roger Scruton. People say, why don't you do an obituary of this guy? Why don't you do an obituary of that guy? I've had this weird thing. I often use that line that Diana Mosley said to me years ago, people die nonstop. And I've had that since the year began. Every single day since this year began, I've known someone in the obituary columns. And I'm not saying they're a great friend or whatever, but they're someone I've met, someone I've encountered over the years, someone I've had some exchange with. Maman Dion, Céline's mum, died today. She hosted a cookery show on TVA in Quebec. And when I met her, that was back when Céline could barely speak three words of English. Barry Tuckwell, the great Australian oboist. I was thinking about him today. He was a classical oboist, but he and Richard Rodney Bennett made a lovely Jerome Kern album that was one of the first LPs in my collection when I was briefly a classical disc jockey. But I love that album, and it opened my eyes to so many obscure little Kern songs like Go Little Boat. He was a wonderful oboist, Barry Tuckwell, very musical family. Oh, I'll end on this, because this is one of those sort of strange kind of wacky thoughts. Barry's sister, Patricia Tuckwell, married the Earl of Harwood, who's a cousin of the Queen. If you saw the Downton Abbey movie that was out a couple of months ago, two of the big characters in that are Princess Mary, the Princess Royal, and her husband, the Earl of Harwood. And their son, and if I get this right, that's the seventh Earl of Harwood, married Barry Tuckwell, this great Australian oboist's violin-playing sister, Patricia. So that's one of those small world things. But my point here is that when Patricia Tuckwell's husband, the seventh Lord Harwood, when he was born, he was sixth in line to the throne. As I said, he's a first cousin of the Queen. When he was born, he was sixth in line to the throne. When he died a couple of years ago, he was 46th. And the thing is about royal families is that if you're, unless you're in the direct line of succession, you spend your entire life getting less and less important. You start off as sixth in line to the throne and you end up as 46th. So you have to do something in between. And do you know who's sixth in line to the throne right now? Prince Harry. And one day when he's very old, he's going to be 46th in line to the throne. And one should have a measure of sympathy for the hard reality of that, that you're when you're born, that's as important as you will ever be. He's going to be 46th in line to the throne, and he should do something like Lord Harwood became a big operatic guy, and I would suggest to Harry that that's the way to being woke isn't the way to do it. Finding yourself, figuring out something you like that's nothing to do with climate change, nothing to do with women's issues, nothing to do with yawn, just something like opera. That's the way. I commend that to you. Anyway, we've gone on a bit too long. Thank you for that. And do join us for our video mailbox. We will see you next time.